is a world where nothing is solved. And someone once told me time is a flat circle. Everything we've ever done or will do, we're going to do over and over and over again.
Hey everyone, and welcome to this special Soapbox edition of the Risky Business Podcast. I'm Patrick Gray, and that was Rust Cole of True Detective Season 1 talking Nietzsche there for reasons that will become apparent later on in this episode. Time is a flat circle. Everything repeats for all eternity. Soapbox is a wholly sponsored podcast series that we do here at Risky.biz, and that means everyone you hear in a Soapbox podcast paid to be here. So that's the disclaimer out of the way. And in this interview, we're chatting with Mark Rogers, the Executive Director of Cybersecurity at Okta. And Okta, of course, is the identity management giant. Last time I checked, they're worth about $30 billion. So yeah, I'm pretty sure you all know who they are. The question that we're exploring in this interview is whether or not we've managed, InfoSec, that is, the InfoSec discipline, whether or not we've managed to move the needle since the Chinese government hacked Google back during the Operation Aurora attacks of 2009. There are some real echoes of Op Aurora in 2021's headlines. The SVR hacking SolarWinds, Chinese APT crews using Exchange O'Days to do their thing. You know, Google learned from Op Aurora and re-architected its whole approach to minimize the chances of these sorts of things happening again. They moved to their implementation of Zero Trust Networks, and they call it Beyond Corp. But the rest of the world has been kind of slow to follow. We're seeing a little bit of movement now, but we've been slow to follow. And that leads us to the question, have we actually moved the needle on InfoSec since Operation Aurora hit the headlines back in 2009? Well, Mark is a bit of a skeptic. He says we have a tendency as a discipline to move on to the next shiny thing and never really solve some of the big fundamental problems. As for me, well, I think we actually have moved the needle, and we now know what it takes to run reasonably secure networks. Not impenetrable, right? We're not there yet, but acceptably secure networks. But Mark makes some good points in this interview, and the main point he revisits a few times during this conversation is that we still do a really piss-poor job collectively on modelling trust. Whether it's trusting the build environment at SolarWinds or a piece of key material that is ultimately responsible for authenticating all of our users, we're just not very good at modeling what it looks like when that stuff goes wrong. So we've gotten better at designing for defense in depth and designing for failure, but we still have some major problems with trust, and those problems aren't going away anytime soon. I'll drop you in here where Mark explains why the current attacks against Exchange servers are a sobering reminder of where we're at. Despite Microsoft releasing cleanup tools, many of these machines are going to remain vulnerable until they're either decommissioned or ransomware. Here's Mark Rogers.
What percentage of companies out there of those 100,000 plus vulnerable Exchange servers do you think are going to be competent enough to even run the Microsoft scripts?
Yeah.
I reckon at least 2/3 of them are going to have outsourced IT who probably don't have any clue about security, who just handle it, because that's what a lot of the smaller shops that have on-prem exchanges look like. They're going to be the ones that are going to be the problem of the future. We've not improved. We've not learned from this, and we've not moved forward. You look at the same thing with vulnerability management itself, right? We've got all of these old vulns being popped, you know, all these end days that are being used to compromise all sorts of organizations, that are being used as part of crimeware packs, they're being used as the sharp end of phishing attacks, all of this stuff. But we haven't thought about how do we make sure that the lower, smaller companies are protected?
Well, because there is a way, Mark, and you know, you say we haven't moved forward, but if you were starting a company now, or if you were a company that was going to stand up email, you're not going to roll an Exchange server. You're going to go for 0365, which to a large degree, you know, washes our hands of problems like this Exchange disaster that we've been dealing with this year.
But are you?
Yes, I believe you are. Look, I understand what you're going to say, which is that if you look at the SVR campaign, there were attacks against 0365. They were targeted attacks. They're a heavier lift. They are a much heavier lift than stringing together a POC that you could just set loose on the IPv4 space. Once you've taken away having to run the actual services from companies, I mean, you're in a better place.
That actually wasn't the argument I was going to use.
Okay, what is
the argument?
Go.
The argument I was going to use is across the world, we are creating policy and friction that inhibits companies from starting their cloud journeys. So things like data sovereignty laws mean that companies in parts of the world are going to look and say, I don't want to stand up my email in this instance because it's going to put my data in country Y. And those challenges, as they get more severe, which looks, you know, with the current socio-political climate, like they are going to get worse, are only going to mean that things like on-prem is still going to be an issue. And that means I think we're going to be dealing with hybrid environments for years to come. And so all of our security strategies have to take into account these hybrid environments that we're going to have to tackle and not consider that, hey, let's just do a big bang and solve all the problems. Because I just don't think that can happen.
No. Look, I certainly agree with you that it's not all going to go cloud overnight. But I think a lot of those data sovereignty concerns, they're not quite as severe as all of that these days. Like, I mean, for, I don't think a lot of places are going to have all that much trouble hosting with the major providers because of data sovereignty concerns. I think some people might think that, but it's not always the case.
I remain to be seen. I mean, I work for a cloud company. I personally believe that the cloud is the right kind of solution to deal with a lot of this stuff, because why spend all your money on your own on-premise investment when you can leverage investment that a large cloud company puts in to give you the latest tools, the latest APIs, and better, you know, threat intelligence and better response times. But we also have to recognize that there's a lift there for these companies to get there, and especially the ones that have been sitting on this massive piles of on-prem investment for decades. Like, for them to jump into the cloud is going to be a real painful problem.
Yeah.
And then the other thing we have to think about is that there is genuinely a security poverty line. You know,
That's more what I was talking about, in that we've solved a big chunk of the problem, which is a lot of the people now who can't patch their exchanges, who can't remediate them, you know, they're the same sort of people for whom going to the cloud is actually easier these days, right? If they're standing up their first email, their first domain, they're going to do that. They're going 0365. They're going for Google's whatever the hell they're calling it this week. You know, they're not going to stand up an exchange server. That's kind of what I was driving at earlier. So a lot of those, you know, easily owned boxes now, they're going to bleed out. 10 years from now, a lot of them won't exist.
But that's email.
Yeah.
Now consider...
But who runs their own IIS these days? You know what I mean?
Okay, and that's email and web. But when you start to look at specific industry silos, like, let's look at medical. Obviously, with my CTI League hat on, I've taken a look at medical. There are a lot of third-party supplied pieces of infrastructure that go into your average medical facility. And those systems are increasingly connected to the internet, so they can phone home, so they can connect to other systems, and they can form part of a massive network. Who's going to patch them? Who's going to maintain security on all of those devices when you're talking about like a small medical facility with like less than 20 people, no security person, outsourced IT, and probably no budget to spend on getting a security consultant to come in and look at stuff?
But isn't this a better problem to have than a situation where, I mean, it just seems insane in retrospect that every company that wanted email had to run their own email server. Do you know what I mean? Like, I get what you're saying. Of course, we've still got problems, but it seems like they're becoming narrower, I think, a little. I mean, I hate to be the optimist here. You know, I work in InfoSec, but I am a little bit, you know, I've been in this a long time, so have you, right? And I think it's easy to be, as you said, you get distracted by the latest pretty thing, but it's easy to see the badness that's going on and not actually see that we have actually come a fair way.
I will agree with you there. We have improved, but I think things are still broken. Like, you know, we knew from 2010 after Project Aurora that we needed to put in place smarter architectures that could handle things like lateral movement from foreign state actors who've gained access to our network.
Well, hang on. I want to intro this because I knew we were going to talk about this. And the way I want to intro this is because you mentioned, yeah, like everyone's freaking out over Hafnium, but like look at Project, Operation Aurora. This was when the Chinese government hacked Google in, I believe it was 2008. Is that right?
2009.
Yeah, around then. You know, here is an example where a company took action. But, and here's where we get a little bit philosophical, time is a flat circle because the same stuff is happening again. But my evidence of progress here, Mark, is that in these SVR and exchange related campaigns, guess who didn't get owned to the best of our knowledge? Google.
So I don't have enough information to be able to say whether Google successfully defended against those attacks because of their architecture, or because they simply weren't exposed, or because they simply weren't targeted, right? Yeah, sure. Google is definitely a pretty good example of how a Beyond Corp / Zero Trust architecture can work. And they're a great success story when you consider it. But, you know, they still have their issues. There have been, three zero-click Chrome O-days in the last quarter alone. But, yeah,
I mean, that's in a Google product,
different
right?
Kind
but we don't have a different kind of problem. We don't have an example that, these have been exploited within Google and there's been lateral movement and crown jewel style information stolen.
But it's I don't think you can hold it up as an example of this is zero trust working because we just don't have the evidence. I'd love for Google to print a report that says, hey, and we saw these attackers come in this way and we were able to defend them, and this is why they didn't manage to make any kind of lateral movement, and this is how we detected them. These are the IOCs we picked up. But we haven't seen anything like that. And that sort of leads me to the conclusion that they weren't targeted. We're talking about SolarWinds, right? Now, if you want to extend it to like everything that might have happened since 2010, yeah, sure, I guarantee you they've got a ton of data that shows that they've successfully defended attacks. But I'm not so sure that they were targeted during the SolarWinds campaign, because I think the threat actors involved in the SolarWinds campaign specifically went after the TTPs that they knew would work. And they targeted organizations that they knew were vulnerable, and they had mapped it all out before. We know they did dry runs for a year before to make sure they got it right. We know they put in several versions of their Sunburst malware. We know there are multiple versions of Teardrop. This was all planned to perfection. In fact, probably one of the best planned campaigns I've ever seen.
No, I know. I mean, it's hard not to admire it, right? Like, because end-to-end, I mean, the only shitty bit was the Cobalt Strike stuff, where you're like, come on, guys, you did everything else so beautifully and bespoke, and, you know, like, why did you use Cobalt Strike?
But then you can't apply that and overlay it with Google because you're talking about different technology stacks.
Yeah.
And you're also talking about an absence of information about that you can use as a comparison. Now, I personally think that the zero trust approach would have made some meaningful difference involved in it. Because, you know, if you rise up to the 30,000 foot view of the SolarWinds breach, what you have is someone being able to come in through a human vulnerability, as most breaches seem to be taking place at the moment. Phishing email of some kind into Office 365 was how everyone believes that SolarWinds development was compromised, into the CI/CD platform, pushed out updates, impacted 30,000 of their customers, 18,000 known direct impacts, and then they stole sensitive material, key material, credentials, certificates, whatever, and use that to move laterally through chains of trust into their target organizations and steal what they were after. Like, that's, if you move up and consider, if I'm able to steal sensitive credentials or key material relating to any chain of trust, then that chain of trust is fundamentally weakened. The old security adage of your chain is only as good as its weakest link absolutely applies in this kind of scenario.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. And it is really the time is a flat circle thing, because I remember working as a reporter back when Opera Aura happened, and it was just such an earth-shattering thing, which was the idea that a government would go after a vendor. It was genuinely shocking at the time. And here we are 12 years later, the same thing, more or less, happens, and everybody's shocked again. So it is funny, right? They're less shocked, but they are shocked. So time is a flat circle. But you just touched on something interesting, right? And I want to dive into that with you, because you were talking about, you know, weaknesses and chains of trust and all of this good stuff. It seems like, so the SolarWinds stuff, okay, whatever. They popped a CI/CD pipeline. They inserted some code. They shipped it. Okay, whatever. Like we understand that sort of attack. That's interesting enough. It's novel enough. But what was really interesting to me was the way that they handled the M365 side of this, right? And instead of popping user accounts, you know, it took me a while to sort of wrap my head around how to best describe this. But it's like those OAuth apps in M365 environments, which are essentially, you know, what I'd call serverless environments, you know, people have written all these OAuth apps, that they essentially operate more on a service account basis than a user account basis. So all of these companies, including Okta, mind you, and this isn't to single you out, it just seems like as an industry, we even did a podcast with Okta last year called Identity is the New Perimeter. And to a large degree, that holds true. But here's an example of where attackers just completely bypassed identity as an issue and used service level access into M365 environments to run riot. And no one could really see what they were doing, because apparently logging is a premium feature in the world of Microsoft, right? So that's where we wound up, right? Is not only could you steal some key material and break that chain of trust, but you could sidestep organizations' existing visibility into what that breach would look like by just being the hacker who flows like water around the rock in the stream, you know? Like it was beautifully done. You know, that whole thing where they got into Azure AD and added their own domain as a federated IDP. Like, brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant. Like, why that doesn't set off alarms in Azure AD, like, that is a failure of Microsoft. Why you don't have to pay extra to be able to enable non-standard external IDPs, like, that is scandalous. But you get my point, right? Which is, yeah, you touched on something interesting there, which is the chain of trust stuff. But what I find interesting is there are more ways to abuse that subversion of the chain of trust than I think people realized.
That's my point. Yeah. That's like my point 100%. We're too obsessed with, oh, these Microsoft TTPs is how they did this. The reality is this is a much bigger problem than that. This is, if you are able to gain a position of trust, you can exploit that trust and you can leverage it to do some really funky stuff. I also believe fundamentally that, you know, just, you know, there are no new scams. There are only old scams that have been updated. Now, if you think back years and years and years ago,
because time is a flat circle, Mark.
Yeah. But what credit cards were most frequently targeted by carders? They loved corporate credit cards. Why? Because those were service credit cards that were used to do a whole bunch of random stuff. And so a few unusual transactions wouldn't stand out on them. And so they became high value prizes for carders to go after.
Yeah, it's a trust premium, isn't it?
Exactly. You've got an account that is able to operate almost invisibly because nobody scrutinizes it because it's so noisy. And therefore, you can leverage it to launder your connections and do stuff that would otherwise stand out, and that you have enough privilege to allow you to do whatever you want. Like popping an e-discovery app for email. Like, e-discovery apps are allowed to suck down every email in an organization because lawyers need that access. You pop one, you've now got complete access to all the emails, and it's normal for that app to be doing that. And this is what I mean by these chains of trust. We have implicit trust in our technology and in our supply chains that we are not adequately defending against. Now, some of that, the answer is things like zero trust methodologies, you know, ensuring that you use contextual access, making sure that if things stand out that change, like attributes change on SAML assertions, something gets flagged or something drops a connection,
But you need to have gamed that out prior, right? And this is what's amazing. Yeah, yeah. This is what's amazing about what SVR was able to do with this whole campaign is they were able to think of stuff that in retrospect seems quite obvious, but we just were not thinking of at the time, you know? And that's how they managed to slide around in all those networks, in all those cloud instances for so long. I mean, it's, again, it's hard to not be impressed.
But I think we have to fundamentally change the way we do risk assessments. Because once you start thinking about it and looking through these lenses, you realize that we're actually in a much worse position than we realize. So now consider something like, for example, we know that people are being targeted. We know that people are the entry points into lots of big companies. And everyone's working from home. And everyone's working in a house with a five-year-old wireless access point that is riddled with vulnerabilities, because how many people at home patch their wireless access points?
Well, and the other thing is too, and this is something that I've been talking about a bit recently on the show, is that everybody, the way people provisioned access into their corporate environments was a VPN. So you've got all of these people, you've got all these people VPNing directly into the corporate network via unmanaged devices at home, which is, that's not ideal.
And they're not being properly risk assessed. Our risk assessment and our compliance programs are still stuck in the ages of where we were when we were sitting in giant towers with on-premise equipment and cloud connections.
But this has been a huge disruptive event this last year with COVID and all of that and this push. And it's funny actually, because I did an interview recently with the head of research from Chainalysis, who said that, you know, it's her belief that one of the reasons ransomware just exploded in 2020 was because of work from home and VPNs and that whole, you know, more ways in, right? Just became a lot easier. And I think there's probably something to that. But a disruptive event like this, you would think will maybe lead to, you know, burn it down to rebuild it. That's the optimist's view, is that maybe as we emerge from the crisis, things might actually get re-architected a little bit more sanely.
As a former CISO who has had many conversations with his boards about the money that gets sunk into pandemic planning and other parts of BCP planning, we've known about the potential for this kind of problem for decades. We just haven't properly risk modeled it because we haven't looked at what the risks are and how they expand out. Consider this. If somebody came to your company and said, this tool, which is a popular tool used by developers, has a massive vulnerability in it, how quickly could you identify all the places where that tool is used and the code that is touched? I guarantee you, most of the companies out there listening could not do that without spending several days of Lyft trying to examine and find things. Now, the same applies to the CI/CD platforms. Like, there is one particular, very popular, very well-known CI/CD platform. Just searching for it on Shodan finds me over 5,000 instances that are connected to the internet.
Now, look, this is a topic area where, you know, we're moving away from sort of companies operational security, right, toward software supply chain security. And that is a whole other thing.
Why is it different?
You're talking about using other people's technology, and in this case, you know, you're talking, well, yeah, no, okay, I see where you're going.
They're all overlapping problems. You know, we're hung up about the fact that potentially it was an Office 365 email that got them into SolarWinds. But if you actually look at the CI/CD platform that SolarWinds uses, there were a bunch of critical vulnerabilities, 11 high and critical vulnerabilities between 2018 and 2020 alone. Three of them critical, two of them in the wild.
Yeah.
So there were a bunch of ways they could have gone in. The fact that we're exposing this kind of infrastructure and allowing people to hijack the very tools that we use to make our sausage means that we're not doing proper risk assessments for these things and understanding that actually, you know what, if somebody got hold of the tools that I use to build my stuff with, that would be really bad.
Yeah. Well, and then you've got that whole issue of supply chain subversion through things like, you know, we've just seen a huge issue pop up in the dependency confusion stuff, right? That's been horrifying. But even before that, like I remember Ben Hawks, who now, of course, runs Project Zero. I remember seeing his talk, and it's a talk that I've cited on this show so many times, but his talk from KiwiCon like 10 plus years ago called A History of Corruption, where he was, you know, he was talking about open source software, but if you could get commit rights, there were instances where you could introduce exploitable bugs by changing like one or two characters in a block of code, okay? And he's like, it's not that hard to subvert the supply chain once you get access, and trust management across the supply chain is just not a thing we're doing at all, because you can't. It slows things down too much. So yeah, I mean, that's the new paradigm, isn't it? We have to operate in a world where there could be vulnerabilities in all of the software that we're using, and there could be the supply chain for the software we're using, and even the software we're building, that supply chain could be subverted as well. And that is difficult to engineer around, zero trust or not. And I think that's kind of your point.
Yeah, exactly. But there are points we can start with. You know, we can start with ensuring that we really know who we're dealing with. So ensuring that we have the right identities for our employees as they access our things, ensure that we have the right identities for our systems as they access things, and control connections as much as we can, possibly using contextual access, using continuous authentication, all of these good things. None of them are foolproof, but all of them mean that lateral movement by an attacker who gains a foothold becomes incredibly hard. And to your point of influencing open source software, it reminds me of a conversation I had with Grug a few years ago. If you were going to put backdoors into a major software product, you wouldn't put a backdoor into it. You'd put a small vulnerability into it that you knew about, that you could influence.
Well, that was Ben's talk. That was his whole thing, yeah. Which is, you know, just change a dash to a colon or whatever the hell it is. I don't code, so I don't know, but I can't remember. But it was along those lines, which is, yeah, just introduce a mem corruption bug that you know about. I mean, beautiful. Ah, chef kiss.
Yeah, absolutely. So given that we can't say that a thing is never going to get compromised, because I think, honestly, we will never get there, but that's fine. Let's engineer to accept that. And let's think about all of these problems that we can solve and actually do something about finishing solving them.
I got to say, too, one more thing before we wrap this up, one more chunk of evidence to the time is a flat circle concept is I did an interview a while ago with Dirk-Jan Malema from Fox IT in the Netherlands, who is an expert on all things sort of Azure AD and whatnot. And, you know, the attack scenario for a typical Windows Active Directory is you go after an admin, you wind up getting their credentials, and then it's party time, right? That's how you do it. You know what it is for Azure AD? Go after the admin, install a browser extension, right? And then your malware is JavaScript, and you capture their session cred from their browser, and then it's party time. And you can actually run Mimikatz over JSON now into Azure AD. So we are right back where we sort of started with this stuff. And lateral movement now is something that happens in the cloud, not on your Windows Active Directory.
As long as you can own the people, you can own the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you got to imagine too that there's people listening to this who might be cyber policy people, right? People who are trying to wrap their heads around this, business leaders, people who work for politicians, things like that. I do get the impression, and it's an informed view, right, after so long doing this, that those people don't really realize how intractable a lot of these problems are.
No, I mean, so what I will say is the conversations I've had with policy folks in the recent months since these last couple of breaches have been way more informed than the conversations I had 10 years ago.
Oh, that's no doubt.
And that is phenomenal. And it shows me that we are closing a gap there. But the problem is, unless you're fundamentally an InfoSec person, you're going to struggle to really understand the depth of these problems. And I don't think InfoSec people fully understand the depth of these problems themselves.
I think there's a few who do. All right, Mark Rogers, that was a really depressing conversation. But no, I think ultimately it's a wake-up call, isn't it? It's a wake-up call. We've got to remind ourselves occasionally that these disruptive things are going to happen. Things are going to come along and surprise us and remind us that we haven't been able to solve these fundamental issues, and it's unlikely we ever really will solve it to a degree that at least an InfoSec person might find satisfactory. Although I will reiterate that point that I made earlier, which is we've been saying everything's broken for 20 years and yet the world is still spinning, you know? Yep. Things are okay. It turns out the world is actually resistant to these weaknesses that we have in our technology in a way that has pleasantly surprised me, to be honest.
The fact that many of the attacks that have been successful are simple means there are ways to solve them.
Yeah.
We just need to get together and use the right tools in the right place and actually start solving some of these problems.
That's it. All right, Mark Rogers, thank you so much for joining us on this edition of the Soapbox Podcast. It's been a real pleasure to argue with you, and I look forward to doing it again.
Thank you very much.
That was Mark Rogers there from Okta. Big thanks to Okta for sponsoring this edition of the Soapbox Podcast. I do hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back soon with some more risky business. We've got a weekly show coming out later this week. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.